get started.
We are on page 18, and we are up to the verse Kapala, verse 21, where it says, "Vayas Hashem Elokim lo Adam ul Ishto," and Hashem made God made for Adam and his wife, "Katnas or Vayal Bishay," He made for them garments of leather, which is skin, and he clothed them, and he put it on them. It's interesting, I didn't really notice this before. We had this in the last pasuk, that it said in the last pasuk that Chava was called Ishto, right? It says in the last pasuk of the cup, "I called on Shem Ishto Chava," his wife. And he also said, "Adon to Ishto," a man and his wife. But in the previous psukim, I believe throughout the parasha, she was just called the Isha, not the Ishto, not the wife of Adam, but rather just the woman. I know none of them right about that. I didn't check it up, but it seems that way to me, that this was actually the first time these two psukim where she's called his wife. That probably has to do with the, that punishment which she got at the bottom of page 16, and the last verse there, where it says, "Verishech chukasech ruim shavach, yet your craving shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." So therefore, since that is the case, so from there, that time she was considered to be his wife, as opposed to being the woman, independently. So I guess that was where that happened. So here it says that he made for the man and his wife these garments of leather, of or, ayin vav resh. There's an interesting Gemara. The Gemara is said in the name Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was, among other things, he was a scribe. And then the Torah which he wrote, it said, Katnos or with an aleph. Or with an aleph meaning? What's or with an aleph?
Right.
So it's interesting that here it says they are garments of leather, and there it says they are garments of light. So the question is this a contradiction? Seems to be a contradiction, right? Because leather and light don't seem to be the same thing. But it would seem that it might not be a contradiction, because obviously if God makes for them garments of leather, then there's something illuminating about these garments, right? What is illuminating about these garments? I imagine, I can't say it because it wasn't there, that these garments had some profound mystical qualities. Now, I do have evidence of that, because it says that these garments were very, very much prized. That after, I don't know exactly how it went down, but from Adam it went down to Nimrod. Nimrod was, of course, one of the major kings at the end of Parshas Noach. And from Nimrod it went down to?
Noach.
What? Who took the garments after Nimrod?
Nope.
Asaph took the garments, right? So obviously they had some powerful capacity. It wasn't the powerful capacity. Again, I don't know, but they were made out of leather. And it means something had to die, some animal, in order for these garments to be made. Now, obviously, Silva's point, not only were men and the woman vegetarians, and they tend to be vegetarians until the time of the model, until the time of the flood. Man begins to be a vegetarian. There is a machlekes, there's an argument in which he was allowed to eat something like roadkill, meaning that if an animal dies, by natural or accidental causes, whether Adam was allowed to eat it, and his progeny, even before the flood. But he certainly was not allowed to kill an animal, take its life, and eat it before the flood. That was only after the flood. So I think that nevertheless, this garment, which is made out of leather, must have somehow manifested Adam's status as the ruler of the world, meaning superior to the beasts. And obviously the reason why he needed a garment to manifest that is because beforehand he had been of great, great stature. Now he lost that stature. So therefore there has to be something artificial so to prop him up. What's propping him up? What's propping him up are these illuminating garments. The Gemara says that before the sentence, and I'm going to take literally this Gemara, it's allusion, it's quite clear. The Gemara says that before the sin, Adam was as high as from the earth to the heavens, stretched all the way up from the earth to the heavens. After the sin, he was 100 amos tall. He was diminished in stature. 100 amos is 150 to 200 feet. Now, it's not to be taken literally. The idea is that before the sin, man's capacity was immense. It transcended the difference between heavens and earth. After the sin, man has a great capacity, at least part of it, expressed in the measure of 100. But it's limited. It's not quite the same thing it was before the sin. Yes?
But how is it from the apple of the tree? How does she reach the apple of the tree? Presumably, with the tree and branches where the fruits are, it's quite hard. Maybe it is literal.
Maybe, or maybe she had a ladder.
A ladder.
There was an apple tree, though. It's not real. Whatever it was, it's either grape or fig or wheat. We don't know what it is. So it doesn't matter. What?
Could it have been an apple?
There's no tradition like that. Even Hebrew, there are sort of say it was a tapuah. Tapuah in ancient Hebrew means an etrog. Because it's a tapuah literally means something which is bloated. So it's a bloated fruit that's considered to be an etrog. According to most sources. So it probably was not, the odds are it was not an apple. I imagine apple is the most common fruit, so therefore they assumed, well, it must have been that she ate an apple. That's why I said that.
I thought it was India where it was.
What? Yeah, I'm saying the Europeans came up with the idea that it was an apple. Yeah.
Ron, about the garments of skin, yeah. And you told us that Esav wore them. You can tell you that the skin that Yaakov used when he talked to his father was this same skin.
Possible,
and that's why they were to deceive in such a way Yitzchak that Yaakov was Esav in this case.
To receive
the animals that Adam was not an animal, but that Adam was superior to them.
Mm-hmm. So, are you?
I am.
No. I thought you were going somewhere with the fact that Yaakov was wearing them when he stole the brachos.
No, he was in such a case to deceive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the skin, let me signify something which is physical, it's not spiritual.
You know, it was out of blood. No, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm agreeing with you.
It doesn't say here, literally it means skin is physical, so therefore when Isaac was going to read the blessing, and he knew he was going to read the blessing to Esau, then Yaakov had to dress himself in physical clothing such as the skin, so that Isaac could read the blessing to him. And in this case it is the same. It says because Hashem clothed them, it is like he imposed the physical dressing on them.
Mm-hmm. Let me expand what you're saying a little bit. The interesting thing, I think, about in terms of Yaakov wearing these garments is that Yitzchak was blind, right? Yitzchak was blind. So the question is, you know, I understand that he has to wear the false hair on his arm in order to indicate that in case Yitzchak comes to touch him. But why does he have to wear Esav's garments, right? Yitzchak can't see the garments he's wearing anyway, right? What? So it could be the smell, but reminds me he smells pretty rotten. He should have smelled pretty rotten anyway because he was wearing these freshly slaughtered goats. So they don't smell so good. So I would say that perhaps that these garments had unique, you know, whatever capacity that they were endowed with when Hashem made them, they probably continued to be endowed with that capacity subsequently, and therefore Adam actually was wearing, you know, I'm sorry, Adam was wearing something which had unique qualities to it, and therefore that was but Esav wore, Yaakov was able to sense those inequalities, and therefore Yaakov had to wear it specifically when he went through to get the brachos. Yeah?
It says that, I've got Rashi over here, the garments of skin, and Rashi says that Kagaron Stema Ha'anavim, such as the wool of rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like that.
It doesn't matter, but it comes from some sort of, first of all, it comes from the tenor, the wool, which in that case is like the wool which is on the skin. Or it means skin. The skin had to be there, right?
Okay.
Actually, what he's saying is this wool was gut warming. It had the capacity to warm him up.
Yeah.
I want to say her name. It's a very, very old Rosh Hashiva in the Mir Yeshiva in Brooklyn. Her name is Rebella Yurkonsky. The family, must be over 100 by now, So somebody told me that, one of the students once said to me that when he came to America, he said, the first thing he said is, I don't understand what happens here in the winter. In the old country, where people used to wear furs in the winter, they used to wear the furs with the skin out and the fur in order to keep themselves warm. And here, when he came to America, he noticed people wear the furs with the skin on the inside and the fur on the outside. So he doesn't understand that our counterintuitive. So it says, after he was here a while, he understood that the reason why people wear furs is not to keep themselves warm, but rather to burn the other person's eyes. So the idea is that the skin, you know, looks like sheepskin clothing, where I assume the wool was on the inside and the skin on the outside, as I think the case was. So I think that there is also, Mary Joshua said, I don't know if Rashi brings it down, that this was actually the snake which Hashem slaughtered and made the garments out of. What? No, no. There is a marriage which Rashi brings down, which is that it was something which is a quality which was given to their body. I mean, that it was like some sort of tough outer skin, like the skin of the substance of the nail, keratin, which makes up the nails, which actually was clothing them. Which of course, it would have been a much more, even more than actually a garment. Some sort of mystical quality would be for that. But that doesn't seem to be the simple understanding of the public. Anyway, what the Malvin says on this is that other Hashem didn't make it to them. It says, if they required garments, God gave them understanding. Right till now, remember the Malvin's opinion is that man started out at this point being dumb, right? Dumb, I mean, in the technological sense of things, because he was not meant to have to deal with all these technological, mundane issues. So he had no clue how to make garments, and that's why the first thing they put on, right after the sin, we saw was weave. So they didn't know how to weave themselves anything, they didn't know how to make themselves anything, so the other thing they knew what to do, take leaves and cover themselves with leaves. But here, God gave him wisdom to make the garments of leather, because he already had began to have the mind to be able to create and invent. He started dealing with craft and with craft and with shaping things. Like he says, he brings down that I don't know exactly where he gets this from. He just says from Chazal, so that the smith, blacksmith and such like, began with Adam HaRishon. He says that brings down from the text from Chachmei HaChakila, the scholars who inquired into things. I don't know what that means, but he said that they said that from this time, man was being prepared to receive the Torah, because the Torah was written on a parchment, which is made out of cards, right? What's going to come eventually, a parchment is made out of hide to save him from being, from the punishment which came as a result of the snake. So that, at this time, Chulam Aleph says, was written on his heart. And it was full of intelligence and fear of God. That was before the sin, it was written on his heart. And now, it has to be written on something external, right? It has to be written on actual parchment. It was no longer inside him because of the sin. So it has to be written on outside of him. And that's why he says, in Rabbi Meir's poem, like I said, it says the word kosnos or with an aleph, in order to indicate that the inner essence of Torah is a light, right, an or, which illuminates the darkness. And somehow, this quality, which would later on be inherent in the parchment on which Torah was written, was somehow inherent on in the leather garments which Adam was wearing at this time. Obviously, if that was the case, then it couldn't be made of the skin of the snake, because the skin of the snake is not suitable for writing with sacred Torah. But suitable for any texture is, of course, only parchment from kosher animals. Okay, so that's what the Malvin says. Yeah?
Right. We say that it seems that this was light, with light, like something positive.
Yeah.
However, in the case of Yaakov, we see that he needed to hide spirituality and show physicality. It is a contradiction.
No, in that case, see, there are different kinds of light, though. In other words, it wasn't something which, according to the understanding that these were the garments which with which man was able to subjugate animals, it wasn't a light which shined on him. The way the Maimon is saying it, this light was really a light which was able to illuminate certain things for Adam, which before were internalized, and now we have to get some out from the outside. But according to the understanding that they were just clothes to fend off the animals or subjugate the animals, so there was no illuminating light for him.
Yes.
It was a light towards the outside. So that wasn't something which caused, you know, Esau or Nimrod or anybody who wore those garments to have any greater degree of holiness.
That's why, but so that light is extended to one other.
That's not a light which would identify a holy person.
A light of what? That is extended
to light,
other.
No, a light which causes others to be afraid.
There's
two types of light. They're both the same kind, but they have two different impacts. Mm-hmm. One light illuminates, and the other light frightens.
Mm-hmm.
So this light which would frighten, not one which illuminates. You see the difference?
That you have darkness as part of the light as well as regular light.
Excuse me?
You think darkness has to be part of the light as well?
Well, I mean, it's a philosophical issue. It's not that darkness is classed as a type of light, but rather that darkness is an artificial thing as light is. It's not taken to be, if I understand correctly what you're saying. There's a question of whether darkness is the absence of light or darkness is a state unto itself.
Right.
So there's an opinion that darkness is a state unto itself, not just the absence of light. So that's still not the same thing as saying that it's light.
No.
But it's something which is generated, it's artificial, but it doesn't mean that it's the same thing as light.
Okay. It seems like if you were Esau's clothes, he probably would have an arm when he went out to go, he was slaughtering as well. When he went out to hunt, even
his
clothes, he probably was in a hunting
street
and he probably would have them. Probably wasn't the same
clothes that Yaakov wore. No, it's an interesting thing. It says that, I don't know exactly why Yaakov wasn't wearing them then. But he didn't wear them all the time, but it says that he left his best clothes at home. Right? Because he didn't trust his wives. He was afraid his wives would sell them, I guess. So pawn them in the pawn shop. So therefore he left his best clothes with his parents, right? And it actually does say somewhere that when Esau went to serve Yaakov, he would wear his best clothes. He would wear his best clothing. Because he was Esau's one quality was that he was mechabed of the aim. He honored his father and his mother. I know his mother, but certainly his father. So, but I guess there was more than one set of clothing of that sort, either because other meant more than one set of clothing, or because Esau had other sets of clothing as well. So anyway, technically we don't know if this is specifically the one which he wore, but we do know that he wore his best clothing in order to serve Yitzchak. And that was what Yaakov wore in order to come meet Yitzchak and seal the brothel. Yeah?
I think the that day, that when the humanity would go out and the hunting was already said that all animals would come because of those clothes. But that night, that day, in fact, sentiment as a pet, I think it was supposed to be Yaakov. So, sentiment without the clothes, he would be able to.
Okay, it's a new one on me.
Okay.
Maybe. Okay, I never heard it before. I'm willing to accept it, but I never heard that before. But before we go to that last Pesukim, it's here by Adam, which talk about his banishment from the Garden of Eden. So I wanted to tell you a very interesting Medrash. There's a book, a very small book called the Medrash Pliya. The Medrash Pliya is not actually a specific Medrash, but rather a compendium of all the very strange and outlandish midrashim which exist. And there was somebody who wrote a commentary on all these strange and outlandish midrashim, so his own spin on them, so he put them all together in this compendium. And one of the first ones is a midrash about Adam. It says that Adam HaRishon once met Cain, asked the Cain thing. And he says to Cain, what was your judgment? Right? My judgment was, what was your judgment? So Cain said, I said it. I did tshuva, and I was able to be, to receive seven generations of protection as a result. So it kind of wasn't tshuva on the spot, but he got seven generations to survive beyond that time. So Adam says, Adam started beating his breast. He said, woe to me. Had I known that tshuva works, I would have done tshuva as well. And immediately, the matter says, he started saying the psalm, which we say after the Chododi Friday night, Mizmor Shir Yom HaShabbos. It's a very strange message. What does it mean? Well, why that tshuva? Why that psalm? Secondly, it seems like Adam did try to do tshuva. As Rashi brings down later in the parsha, if you take a look, on page 22 of Pasuk Chof Hei. Rashi doesn't bring it down. But in the Rashi in that pasuk, the fourth line from the bottom of the Rashi, the second column, so it talks about the whole Rashi, the beginning of the pasuk Chof Hei. It says that Lamech was ultimately the one who killed Cain. He came by mistake. He shot arrows, shooting arrows down the field, and he hit Cain by accident. So at that point, after Cain was killed, so his wives, who were upset at him for killing his great-great-grandfather, Lamech was upset with Cain, refused to live with him anymore. So Lamech went to Adam Marishon, who was still alive and kicking, and said to him, he complained. So his wives left him. So Adam called the wives, right, who also was great-great-grandchildren, obviously, and said, why are you not sticking around with Lamech? So he said, because he killed somebody. So he said, it doesn't matter. Even if he sinned, you're still his wife, you should go back there. So he said, then listen, you're a hypocrite. Because as says that after Adam Arishon sinned, for 130 years, he stayed away from his wife, doing tshuva. Says he sat in a river for 130 years. I guess it was trying, like, I don't know exactly what the point of that was, but somehow or another, that was part of his tshuva. So they said that for 130 years you haven't been with your wife. So you're full blown, right? First you take care of yourself before you come to us. So it says at that point, Adam Rishon said, okay, fine, you're right. He went back to his wife, and then he conceived Shem, who was actually began the line, which ultimately culminated with Avraham Avinu 20 generations later. So the question is, for 130 years he did tshuva, right? So what do you mean he didn't do tshuva? On the other end, Chazal say that for those 130 years, until he conceived Shem, Adam Arishon was giving birth, he was conceiving and giving birth to all sorts of demons and bad spirits. It's very strange. He's trying to do tshuva, sitting in this river for 130 years. Obviously, these demons and bad spirits are not conceived like human beings are conceived. Somehow or another, all sorts of strange things are going on, and he created all these negative forces in the world. Moreover, the rabbis say, it's an amazing thing they say about Adam Arishon, the amazing critique, they say that Adam Arishon was Moshech Be'olwaso. What is Moshech Be'olwaso? Adam Arishon was born circumcised. And after the sin, he tried to develop for himself a fourth sin. There was such a thing when in the days of the Hellenists, so the Hellenist Jews were embarrassed because they were circumcised, and in sporting events and such like, they had to compete naked. So there was some sort of operation which they actually had, I don't know exactly how it worked, in which they would make for themselves an artificial foreskin, in order that they should look uncircumcised. Right? It was probably pretty painful. But they did it, because obviously they were most necessary. They were very fervently fervent in getting themselves to look like real Greeks. And the Gemara says that somebody who's embarrassed because he's circumcised, he is kind of a terrible person. And he is going to suffer very, very badly in the world to come. So it says that Avraham Avinu, the Gemara Erevin says, that Avraham Avinu sits at the opening to Gehenna. This is, again, not to be taken literally, but there's a message here. Avraham Avinu sits at the opening to Gehenna, and he saves every Jew from going into Gehenna, except those who are Moshech Barlosa, except those who attempted to give themselves artificial foreskins. Because obviously Avraham Avinu represents us, the first Brit Mila, right? And that's the basic element of, you know, the first mitzvah given to the Jews as children of Avraham Avinu. So somebody who does that kind of denies the covenant with Avraham Avinu, so Avraham Avinu is powerless to help it. So here it says, the Chazal say that Adam Rishon was Moshe Barato. It was a very strange thing, right? What does it mean that he kept on pulling at his aura, trying to make himself an aura? Didn't he know that he had done the wrong thing, right? He had done the wrong thing, and obviously what he's doing is no longer, obviously he knows that what he's doing should no longer, what he did no longer should do. Moreover, we mentioned about Adam Rishon, that Adam Rishon said that in the Pasuk, in page 16, in Pasuk, in Pasuk, in Pasuk Yudayis and Pasuk Yudzimel, 12 and 13, the Pesukim both end, 12 and 13, the Pesukim both end, Adam said, I was given from the fruit bowl of hell, and I ate. And the Chava also said, I was given from the fruit bowl of hell, and I ate. The Chazal said the word bowl of hell can be interpreted not just as past tense, but as present tense. Bochel and I am eating. And Chazal says that Adam Rishon said to God, you know what? I ate and I'm going to keep on eating. Achalti vochal ol. I'm going to keep on eating from the tree. It's like going like this to God. I ate and I'm still going to continue to eat. So that's something in his nose. But the question is, of course, the other God is talking to you and saying, what's going on here? And you're saying, so it's very strange, which Chazal is telling us. So obviously all the message of all these midrashim is to tell us, as we will put these gemaras, is to tell us that Adam HaRishon, after the sin, and this is the quality and nature of the sin which he had committed, was instilled in himself, as we said over the past few weeks, the quality of desiring evil, desiring bad things. Even if he does tshuva, it's still base and core desires are going to be desires which are elementally negative. By now, as we mentioned way back before the sin, Adam Rishon, when he identified himself as something holy, and the negative inclination is something outside of himself, represented here by the snake, now man is his desires. You know, what he wants to eat, what he wants to drink, what he wants to do, the women that he wants, all that kind of stuff, and the good inclination kind of has to harness that as something almost extrinsic to a human being. And therefore, man, at this point, it's not that he wanted to say, I'm going to eat more, but that was the nature of man after the sin. The nature of man after the sin is that he continues to eat. He won't be able to avoid continuing to eat or being tempted to continue to eat because that's the quality which he has. Also, even though he attempts to do tshuva, right? So what does his tshuva consist of? His tshuva consists of, obviously, he's sitting separate from his wife for 130 years, up to his neck in water, in the river, whatever it was. He's being morose. He's upset. He's depressed about the sin. He should be morose. He should be depressed. But that's not what tshuva is, right? In this case, the fact that he was morose and depressed about the sin was not at all what tshuva would be. Tshuva would be to attempt to work on those desires, and which he now has, to uplift them and make them holy again, in some way, shape, or form. But in fact, he remained the person, that's what Chazal says, when they're saying this Moshe Falasa. What man especially was trying to obliterate his bris milah? That was the quality which the sin introduced to him, that now he became a bundle of desires. And since he became a bundle of desires, something which signifies that. I don't even know if he literally did that. But the Chazal was saying that he was attempting to make himself a foreskin, is that he was attempting to take that kedusha, which a circumcision gives a person and enables him to elevate himself above pure desire. Adam HaRishon was no longer capable of that type of behavior. His desire was him. Obviously, it was not till Avraham Avinu that full rectification of that began. Even Avraham Avinu didn't fully rectify it, it was a process. But this was a process from Adam and Rishon, things were going downhill, desire was not able to be harnessed in a way which was good. And as a matter of fact, it was not. There were no mitzvot that go together which made desire a good thing. That's important to know. The difference between a non-Jew and a Jew to this very day is that the mitzvot which non-Jews have are not mitzvot of indulgence. And therefore, a non-Jew, to this day, most non-Jews define sanctity as separating from this world. Just go live as a monk or a hermit or something else which is separating from this world and negating the pleasures of this world. And they're right. If they want to be holy, they have to separate themselves from the pleasures of the world because they have no way to use those pleasures and that type of pursuit in any positive way. And Adam Rishon had no way, he couldn't fathom how he could use those things the right way. So therefore, all he could do is separate. Right? And again, until that's this very day, and that's reflected in halacha, is that a goy who brings a korban the Beis HaMikdash cannot bring a korban shlomim. He can only bring a korban oyla. What's the difference between a shlomim and an oyla? Who is the shlomim? And? Who is the right, one who sacrifices. The Kohen, and the Shlomo, anybody can eat from it. Any Jew can eat from the Shlomo. Who eats from an Ola? Nobody. Why? Because from the perspective of a non-Jew, they don't have this concept of using this world in the right way. The only way to use this world is to devote it completely to God. And that's why there's a Gemara in Pesachim, that's kind of set, very famous Gemara, that says that even though Rabbi Eliezer is a Tana who holds that on a Yom Kippur, other than Shavuos, you don't have to eat, drink, and make merry. You can just learn all day. And Shavuos, you have to have a special, you have to indulge. You have to have, eat and drink and make special meals. Why? Because he says the Torah was given on Shavuos. What does it mean the Torah was given on Shavuos? On the contrary, the Torah was given on Shavuos, so you shouldn't learn all of Shavuos, right? Well, you're going to eat and drink, we'd expect the opposite. But what he's saying is that the capacity is not my idea, everybody says it, that the capacity to eat and drink for the sake of heaven is something which the Torah gave us. Because before the Torah was given, there was no concept of eating in sanctity. There's only not eating in sanctity. To eat in sanctity, that's something which the Torah gave us a special quality. Now, in this Medrash about Adam HaRishon not opening with Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbos, it's obvious now why he said that tehillah. What does that tehillah have to do? Why Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbos? By the way, if you look at the tehillah Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbos in a sitter, they're going through Shabbos. Anybody ever notice that? Next Friday night, after the Chazogi, when you say Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbos, pay attention. Only the first point has anything to do with Shabbos. This is a problem, right? What exactly this tehillah has to do with Shabbos? I'll have to deal with that today. First, I want you to look at it and see what you can come up with yourself. But the idea of Shabbos is Oneg Shabbos. What's the idea of Oneg Shabbos? The idea of Oneg Shabbos is that there's a revolutionary idea, if you think about it, which is that Tanugim, all sorts of pleasures, eating, drinking, having relations with one's wife, all sorts of things which are normally considered to be the desires of this world, and perhaps to be taken to be base and negative desires, I consider on Shabbos to be a mitzvah. So a mitzvah to indulge. And a mitzvah to indulge means that these things are part and parcel of a sacred pursuit. You need content. Non-Jews don't have it. A goy shel Shabbat chayav mitzvah. A non-Jew who keeps Shabbos is put to death, not literally. But it means that he's liable to death because he doesn't have any affinity for Shabbos. That's not his. And he doesn't have that capacity, that approach. So the idea of tshuva, from this perspective, of Adam HaRishon would have been not to refrain and not to separate and at the same time have all these negative thoughts and desires which he internalized at the time when he got this Yetzer Hara inside and after eating from the Yetzer Hara, but rather tshuva would have been to redirect his desires and aspirations towards things which are holy. And you don't see that anywhere in the Chumash. You don't see Adam HaRishon after the sin have any desire to go back up, to elevate himself and make his channel his desires towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As a matter of fact, the next Pesukim, which we're going to see tomorrow, We're going to see how Adam Rishon is thrown out of Gan Eden, and the truth is he makes no attempt to get back. You know, it's true, God put barriers in front of him, but he still could try. And he didn't try to get back. Why? Because he kind of resigned to the situation. Now, the flaw in my interpretation, one second, is that what I don't have exactly down pat, which I would have to have down pat in order to explain the matters fully, is how Chaim did Tshuva, in a way which was considered to be, you know, restoring himself to the situation before the sin, right? In other words, I explained to you very well, I hope, how Adam Rishon, by using the message of Shabbos, would have been able to restore himself to the situation where desire was for good things, desire in the context of a mitzvah. But he only understood this after having spoken to Cain. And as Cain doesn't have done any great tshuva, right? We'll see when we get to Cain what he did. Maybe we'll find an answer. But right now, there's no clear-cut correlation between the tshuva that Cain did after killing Hevel and what Adam Marishon would have done had he instilled within himself the message of Shabbos. Yeah?
I'm sorry, I
don't want you to answer the question today.
Oh, okay.
Well, we don't have time. Come on. See, remind me, okay? There's one other thing before I stop, which is that, I really should have left a few minutes open up and got carpal, but a lot of rolls. One other thing is that I started mentioning this last week before we had the special speaker that day, that, and I want to go back to it today. I think I finished it also, but let me just repeat it now in this context, that the Kabbalists say that the four levels of klipos, the four levels of things which are impure in this world, and three levels of these klipos, the three bottom levels, are off limits. There's nothing we can do with them. We just have to avoid them. But the fourth level, which is, so to speak, the highest level, is the level of klipas noga. Klipas noga is literally the husk which has a glow to it. What does it mean it has a glow? There's residual light to it. It's not completely dark. So where's the light? The light is the capacity to glow, just like charcoals which are glowing, you can blow on them and ignite them, so too this klipa has certain capacity. And says in the Kabbalah, this klipa represents all things which are different rishus, or the rishus, optional activities, right? I'm like, everybody's about, you're about to go to lunch, right? So lunch today is an optional activity, right? You're probably, and that's not a mitzvah today to have lunch, unless you're making a seum. Is anybody here making a seum today? No, probably not, right? So therefore, lunch day is an optional activity, right? So when you have this optional activity of eating lunch, say from a religious standpoint, right? You might feel it's mandatory to eat lunch, but from a religious standpoint, it's not necessary to have lunch, right? So therefore, that lunch is optional. So you can use this optional lunch to satiate your hunger, to satisfy your thirst, as most of us will use it, without thinking about the fact that I can use this lunch and will use this lunch to fortify myself to learn more Torah this afternoon. It might not go through my mind at all, right? In which case, the lunch remains the Dvar HaRashus. It remains something which has a glow, which doesn't actually, so to speak, ignite itself. But if a person eats a lunch or anything else, the Shane Shindor does anything else which affords him pleasure and uses that pleasure for the sake of heaven, then that is taking that Klipat Noga and using it for the sake of heaven and uplifting it and bringing out the light, the full light which it can possibly contain. So a person's mission in this world, from the Kabbalist perspective, is to take the basnoga, all the optional activities, and uplift them by doing them for the right reasons, with Shem Shamayim, whether it be for an Shabbos, whether it be to learn Torah, whether it be in the context of the Sudas Mitzvah, whether it be in order to make a bracha with more fervor, whatever the case may be. And use that for those reasons and channel their those indulgences and pleasures into the pursuit of a higher form of activity that it shouldn't be fretting, should be eating stop, but should be eating for the sake of heaven. And sometimes, many obviously along the way, many people use the tact of refraining, of becoming abstinent until they're able to master this capacity. So it doesn't mean most people can't jump in and say right away, oh, yesterday I ate a steak because I enjoy steak. And today I'm going to eat a steak because it's going to give me power to live, right? It doesn't usually work that way. It takes a process. So therefore, there are those who, in the Jewish tradition, who had champion abstinence at least as a tool to get to that point where one is able to control one's desires and use them for the sake of heaven. But in any event, the idea is that a person should be able to use his desires for the sake of heaven on Shabbos. It's very easy to do so, and the rest of the week it's not so easy to do so. And that's what other Rishon would have had to do in order to do proper tshuva, so to speak, to get back to Gan Eden.
What's that? You should bring out the holiness and the actual invite in kosher food.
What? No.
Like, can you actually...